is the fall line. In this series, we speak with people who have seen gaps in the way that we report on, record, and disseminate information on violent crime. These advocates, journalists, scholars, and researchers have recognized the need to create more complete databases of the violent crime experienced in the United States and beyond. That can mean cataloging the missing, the murdered, the unidentified. It can involve looking for patterns of concern, like the clusters identified by the Murder Accountability Project. It can mean making the first national database to catalog John and Jane Doe's. Or, in the case of our interview subject today, Anita Lucchesi, it can be a project that is threefold: a desperately needed, totally original, and trauma-informed database. Lucchesi set out to do what no government has managed, or even tried to manage: to record the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people in North and South America. We first became aware of Anita Lucchesi's work in 2018. That's when we were trying to find meaningful statistic information on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the southeastern U.S. After speaking with Anita on that project, we knew we wanted listeners to hear more about her work. So we'll let Anita introduce herself. In her own words.
My name is Anita Lucchesi, and I am a Cheyenne descendant and executive director of Sovereign Bodies Institute. I am also a PhD student at the University of Arizona in the School of Geography, Development, and Environment. My academic research is on Indigenous data sovereignty within the context of geography. So looking at how maps and geographic research can be done in a way that promotes Indigenous sovereignty through thinking about issues of data. But I also look at how geographic information, as well as research on violence against Indigenous women, have kind of gone hand in hand over centuries of colonial occupation to better support colonial systems of power. So looking at the way that data is used to both explore and violate Native lands and Native women. In my role as director at SBI, I oversee our Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit database, as well as a number of community-based projects. We are an international nonprofit research center, so we're based in the U.S., but we work in Canada. We have a sister collective in Mexico and a project in Peru, and our data extends from Canada all the way through the U.S. and Latin America. So we're always looking to work beyond colonial borders. And I'm joining you today from Wiat territory in Northern California.
You're also a cartographer. We'd love to know how your work doing cartography has informed your work as a data researcher and vice versa.
Well, I think most people imagine cartography and mapmaking as something that takes special fancy software or all sorts of technical expertise. And certainly there are fancy softwares that do take technical expertise, but anybody can make a map. I think all of us at one point in our life have made a map, even if it was just as a kid making a treasure map. All of us understand the basics of it. And so I was really fortunate that when I was learning how to make maps, as an undergraduate college student, I was also learning about post-colonial theory for the first time and learning from like these amazing writers that were talking about these moments in our collective global history where people were working to decolonize for the first time or in this major moment, right? And as a Native student that was still living under colonization, And also learning about how to use maps to tell stories, it was just like this life-changing moment or life-changing collision. And so I learned to think of maps as ways that we can reconnect with each other, reconnect with the land, tell really powerful stories of violence that have so much freedom in them. And what I mean by freedom is you get to decide how much you share what it looks like, what the boundaries are, like all the pieces of it, the symbology, everything, the timeline, and it can be totally freeing. So my master's thesis that led to the creation of the database was on how we can use maps to tell stories of violence in Indigenous communities. And MMIW was one of the issues on one of the maps. And so that's kind of how those two worlds collided. But I think the true beauty of maps is that they are really democratic, and they're this beautiful interweaving of data and art. And data and art that tell stories about us, our relationships to each other, our relationships to the land that we're on and the spaces we navigate. There's no other medium that does that. And I know I sound like a super nerd right now, but I just think maps are one of the only things that are legible to people who are illiterate. Think about how powerful that is. So that's kind of how I got interested in cartography and data, and how those two things can be brought together to think through analyzing violence in our communities.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of Sovereign Bodies Institute, or SBI, why it was started, its mission? My understanding is that the Institute does a lot. We have research, advocacy, community outreach, family and victim support, a wide array of scholarship and support for communities in general.
It's true. We definitely try to do a lot. So Sovereign Bodies Institute was started as an official home for the database. The database started as just kind of a grassroots community project about 5 years ago. And it really kind of started by accident. I was working on a school project and I needed a good working number of how many cases of missing and murdered Native women there were in the U.S. and Canada. And at that time, there was numbers and lists for Canada, but none of them matched. And there really wasn't any list or number for the U.S. So I thought, well, what if I just cross-reference all these lists and news articles and I can come up with a number that way? And I was kind of naive in thinking that there would be a start and an end to that project. And now 5 years later, it's become my life's work. So in late 2018, we decided that the database was growing in so many ways that it was important for it to have a safe home where it wasn't just something I did as a passion project, but that it was something that truly belonged to the family and something that had potential to continue to grow. So we built SBI as its new home and launched in early 2019. The database is kind of like the foundation or bedrock of what we do. But all of the other projects that we do kind of grow out of it. The way I see it is like the database is like the nurturing soil, and all of our projects are flowers growing out of it. The projects that we do are oftentimes inspired by teachings from the data or things that we've learned or questions that we've had or relationships that we've built through gathering the data. So they always are kind of growing out of the database effort. The database gets updated on a regular basis. We have several staff who work on it, including myself and our data analyst, Aaron Fisher. So it's something that's always continuing to grow, not just in number of cases, but also the kind of information we track. And then the projects that grow out of it, we also have new projects happening all the time. So to give folks a sense of what we do in terms of our other research projects, we have work that we've done on this issue as it pertains to extractive industries and sexual violence in MMIW. We have a partnership with the Yurok tribe to address MMIW throughout Northern California. We've got 5 Indigenous women scholars that we support in doing their own community-based research with their community. And that includes a healing center on forced sterilization in Peru, a blueprint model for girls empowerment centers in urban Canada, healing dance groups for MMIW families. We're trying to be as, robust as possible, I guess you could say, with the understanding that all of these projects are things that benefit not just that one community, but all the communities that we serve, because it's a blueprint that other Indigenous communities can take and adapt or modify to suit their needs. So the way we look at research is with the understanding that there's nobody who can solve these issues better than us. There's nobody, and by us, I mean Indigenous peoples. There's nobody that knows our communities better than us. And especially for survivors and MMIW family members, there's nobody that knows these issues better than us. So if we invest in supporting other Indigenous women or scholars, but especially survivors and family members, invest in their efforts to come up with new ways of not just documenting violence, but addressing it, healing it, preventing it, I think that's where we're going to get some really great paths to justice and healing and safety for our communities. So that's kind of SBI in a nutshell. We're always growing in terms of our projects, the data, our staff. We're lucky, even though we're a new organization, we've grown quite a bit since we first started. And I think that just speaks to the need in our communities for this kind of work.
That really speaks to, I think, one of the first things that struck us about how SBI gathers data. And that's that specifically trauma-informed approach that you have to research for your database and all of your projects. You get information from larger bodies like the federal government, but you also reach out one-on-one to families of the missing and murdered. Can you talk a little bit more about that method?
Sure. Well, I think all of our work at SBI is grounded in, like I said, I'm a scholar of data sovereignty, and it's not enough to just be Indigenous and say, okay, that's Indigenous data sovereignty. For us, it's also about survivor and family sovereignty. For me as a survivor, I trust other survivors to speak for me, but I don't trust, I don't think, just anyone in the general public could speak to my experience or what I went through. So I think it's important for us to be able to speak for ourselves, and it's part of our healing journey as survivors and as those impacted by violence. So that's a big kind of theoretical underpinning to all of the work that SBI does. One of the things I'm most proud of is that our board, our staff, we have a survivors council. Almost all of us are survivors of violence or a family member of someone who's missing or murdered. So it's actually, the rule, not the exception, in our organization to have the work led by people impacted by the violence. And that translates into how we do our work and how we function, including how we interact with families and survivors. So I think really our greatest accomplishment is the relationships we've been able to build with families across the continent. And able to build their trust. One of the things that's important to us is so many families who've gone through this loss, they've been burnt in so many ways. They've been burnt by the system. They've been mistreated or neglected or forgotten by their own community sometimes. And they're deep in grief and trauma. And any work done on this issue needs to be centered on healing that rather than adding to it. So we try to work with families in the best way possible and support them in having the final say on anything that has to do with their loved one's case, anything that has to do on advocacy in their region or their community, and really empower them to take leadership on the issue and also provide support. We didn't start out as a direct services organization, but it's something that kind of came natural to our work. And one of the things we learned early on was that our research is strongest when our people are strong. Our work will always be strong when we take care of our people while we do it. And so it's not really up for debate about, you know, whether to provide services anymore or whether to, like, kind of where the line is of like, okay, we're going to come in and we're going to take your stories and leave. That's the historic relationship that Indigenous people have to research. And unfortunately, that dynamic still takes place in a lot of areas, but we've decided to do something different. And that means that we are building these relationships for the long haul. And the families that we work with, most of them have my personal cell phone number. They'll call me. I've had a family call me at 3 a.m. And that's fine. That's what we're there for. And sometimes it's not just working on their loved one's case. It's providing general emotional support or helping them find a good therapist or even just helping them navigate other things that come up in their life. I think one of the things that people don't realize is that when you lose a loved one to violence like this, that grief never fully goes away. And even if the case has been brought to justice, you still have every birthday, every graduation, every holiday, you miss that person. That never goes away. And so I think for a lot of these families, the support services, like, there can't be an expiration date. Unfortunately, victim services often does have an expiration date or a max dollar amount. And for us, that's just not, that's not how we can operate. So we have families that we work with who lost their loved one 30 years ago. And we still provide them services and always will. There's no expiration date on anything we do because we know that even something that happened 30 years ago, there can still be acute needs that the family has on their loved one's case and just, you know, the general ripple effect. One of the things we've seen especially is elders who are raising grandkids because their daughter was murdered. Those elders are often on a fixed income, weren't prepared to be raising young children, and need a lot of support. And that's continuous. So like last year, we had kids of MMIW families make Amazon wish lists, and we bought everybody Christmas presents that they picked out. That's not like a normal research institute doesn't necessarily do that kind of thing. But I think that's what it means to do Indigenous research, is to think as holistically as possible about how to take care of our people while gathering and caring for their stories.
I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about the database developed by SBI, because I know that was one of your original goals. What is the database that you've been working on? What kind of information are you gathering?
The database tracks missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. Two-Spirit is a word that we use to describe Indigenous folks who are on the LGBT spectrum. And the database, when it started about 5 years ago, it extended to Canada and the U.S. And last year, we launched a sister database for Latin America. The database primarily tracks cases from 1900 to the present. Most of the data, over 75% of it, is post-1980. Just because that data is much easier to gather and access. When we find older data, we don't actively look for it, but when we find it, we document it in a separate database because we don't want to say that that person doesn't count just because it happened a long time ago. So we have a separate home for that. And the database, I think the most beautiful part about it is that it's such a reflection of the expertise of Indigenous people and Indigenous communities across the continent. So over the last 5 years, we've traveled to different Indigenous communities and done workshops and teaching sessions and different advocacy or awareness events. And everywhere we go, we talk about what kind of data we track and how we gather it and what kind of information we have that's pertinent to that community. And everywhere we go, there's people that don't just add new cases, although that happens too, they actually shape the database itself. So we have people that will say, hey, have you thought about tracking this? Or it'd be really great if you added that. And whenever we get those suggestions, we incorporate them. So the database grows not just in number of cases, but in terms of the scope of the data itself and the depth of the data and the depth of the stories. So that's really, I think, what makes it so powerful. The other piece of it that I think makes it special is it's really reflective of data and stories from our communities themselves. So we start with missing persons databases, and we file Freedom of Information Act requests with law enforcement, but that data is riddled with inaccuracies, whether it's racial misclassification or misclassification of a case by saying that she died of exposure rather than murder. So we start there, but we know we can't end there. So we augment it with historical and tribal archives, news articles, social media posts, and then a lot of direct outreach with families and communities. And I would say the most that we've learned is by doing deep dives with families on their loved ones' cases. There's crazy, bizarre gaps in the system or weird loopholes that happen that would never even occur to me that I've learned just from being in conversation with families and adding their loved one to the database. So that's kind of in a nutshell what it looks like. It started out really basic. It started out in an Excel spreadsheet. I do not have a background. Like, now I'm in Indigenous data sovereignty, but I came to that through working in the database. Prior to starting the database, I had no kind of data science experience whatsoever. So it was very grassroots and humble. When I started it, I still had a broken hand from abuse that I had recently escaped. I typed the first couple hundred entries with a broken hand. And that's kind of the spirit of the database and what we do in general.
Does the geographic location of a missing person or a victim or an unidentified person affect your ability to gather data on them?
Absolutely. It varies by jurisdiction, even, you know, from one state to the next, one city to the next. But then also, of course, the data is always going to be richer in places where there's a large Native community, especially a community that is already passionate on this issue. So, for example, our data in Montana is really strong because Native communities in Montana have been at the forefront of this movement in the U.S. for quite some time. And there are other areas where people don't imagine Native people to be, that rarely get covered by the press, if it gets covered at all, don't necessarily get policymaker attention. And really that just has to do with stereotypes about Native people rather than the actual realities of the violence. So California is a great example of that. But also, I think North Carolina is a great example. We had filed a request with the state of North Carolina for data on missing Native people throughout the state. And just from 2000 to 2018, I believe, I'd have to go back and look at it, at the sheet in particular, because we asked every state for this. But, you know, just within that range, they had given us almost 6,000 incidents that had occurred. So it is an issue in North Carolina. And I know that there's been discussion of quite a few murders of Native women in North Carolina, particularly Lumbee women, to the point where there's been discussion of possible serial killers targeting Lumbee women. And that never gets covered at all. And oftentimes Native people don't acknowledge it either, maybe because they don't fully see, you know, because they're not federally recognized, don't see Lumbees as Native, or just forget that there are places like North Carolina that do have large Native populations because there's so many stereotypes about where Native people are or what they look like. I think a big part of it too is anti-Blackness, particularly in the Lumbee example. So many people expect Natives to look a certain way, that when there's tribes that historically have a long history of mixing with African-American communities, they don't meet the stereotype of what a Native person is supposed to look like because of that anti-Blackness. And so they toss those cases aside or don't give them the coverage that they deserve. And we see that in law enforcement data constantly, where especially if a victim is racially mixed or if they're Black presenting, they're less likely to be documented as Indigenous or acknowledged as Indigenous, even if they're an enrolled tribal member. And so that's, I think, one of the barriers that makes it hard is in areas where there's histories of racial mixing. Like I would say the Southwest too, like when there's so many Native people that are also Latinx, it's really hard to get accurate data because so many law enforcement just look at a person and make assumptions. And those areas where that happens or where law enforcement don't have a strong relationship with tribal communities, the data is just exceptionally poor.
We know SBI has also worked to gather information on the cases of missing and murdered Two-Spirit people. Are there extra layers of difficulty faced when attempting to gather that data?
Yes, that's the hardest data for us to gather. Our Two-Spirit relatives are often misgendered in law enforcement documentation, especially if they're trans. And trans women in particular, I think I've just seen horrible media coverage using straight up slurs to reference them that don't acknowledge their gender identity or who they were as a person. And so that's really challenging. That's typically what we see in law enforcement documents or in media. And even that's exceptionally rare. Most of the time, we don't see those cases covered at all. And unfortunately, we also don't see our communities, Native or not, rally around those cases. And I know that there's been a national dialogue on murders of Black trans women for the same reasons. They're targeted for violence in really horrific ways, and they don't get the same amount of support or advocacy as other murder victims do, because there's so much ignorance and prejudice around our trans women sisters and our Two-Spirit relatives in general. And that's one of the things that SBI is trying to work to address. We hired a Two-Spirit project coordinator earlier this year. His name is Lenny Hayes. He's Two-Spirit and Indigenous and survivor and a counselor. So he's just been a wonderful addition to our team. And his work has been leading all of our efforts on addressing violence against Two-Spirit people and helping us to try to build up our data on missing and murdered Two-Spirit people and work directly with their families, who are, in addition to navigating grief and a justice system that doesn't care about them and all of the other things that all the other families go through, they're also navigating their own family's feelings about their loved one's gender identity or sexual preferences, maybe prejudice from the community or ignorance from law enforcement. There's so many added layers to it. So we're really lucky to have Lenny on the team to help us with that. And to help us, we're also hoping to do a study on violence against our Two-Spirit relatives in general, not just missing and murdered, but other forms of violence as well, because we know that they also experience higher rates of sex trafficking and sexual and physical violence too.
Do you take unidentified persons in the database?
Yes, we do. There's over 100 Jane Does in the database.
How do you decide who gets entered into the database and what kind of cases do you gather?
So we know that there's many cases that get misclassified due to race or due to case classification. And we do our best to err on the side of caution by including anyone that we may think of as Indigenous in the case of Jane Doe's, but also even in terms of people whose identities are known, we don't require that they be an enrolled tribal member or part of a federally recognized tribe. We do include unrecognized tribes, and we also include those who are descendants. And we include folks who are Indigenous to areas outside of the U.S. or Canada. So one of the things that I think is really interesting is that we've documented several cases of women from tribes in the U.S. who have been killed in Latin America, and then women from indigenous peoples in Latin America who have been killed here in the U.S. And so we know that our peoples historically have always moved, and that these borders didn't exist, and that still happens to this day. And unfortunately, even when they move to another country or another place on the continent, our relatives are still at risk. I think another important thing to add is that we feel very strongly about including our Two-Spirit relatives in this work and in the data. And that includes our people of, all genders or sexual preferences, as long as they identify as, somewhere on the LGBT spectrum or as Two-Spirit. We do include them because they're victims of colonial patriarchy as well. In terms of what kind of cases we include, I think that's where information really differs from law enforcement or government agencies, because there's so many cases that are wrongfully misclassified. And that's where we found all sorts of crazy system loopholes. And the one that I think is most powerful to share is that there's a couple of families that we work with where their loved one died of a head injury. And the official cause of death was listed as alcoholism. And in both of these scenarios, their loved one was a habitual drinker and could be considered an alcoholic. But in both cases, and this is like two different hospitals, two different states, two different years, like completely different contexts. But in both of these cases, these women were experiencing extreme domestic violence at the hands of their partner. It was documented. It took place over a lengthy period of time. Both of them were unsheltered or transient because they were trying to escape the abuse. Both of them went to a hospital, to an ER with a head injury, and said that they had been beaten by their partner. Told that to medical professionals. And then both of them went into a coma and eventually died from a subdural hematoma. And the official cause of death that's listed on the autopsy report is alcoholism. And when we talked to law enforcement in both of those cases, they said, well, she was a habitual drunk. She had a high blood alcohol content when she came into the hospital. She probably just fell over a lot, and because drunks fall over, and that's why she has all these bruises. And I get that, but I also think that if these women both came in, said they were being abused, said that they had experienced a violent attack, they should be believed. And to say, well, she was an alcoholic, we can't believe her because she probably was lying that she was beaten and just fell over a bunch of times. That's the most racist loophole I could possibly imagine, because there's so many racial stereotypes about Native people being alcoholics. So those are the kinds of case misclassifications where if you went to a law enforcement agency and asked them, how many murdered Native women do you have in your jurisdiction? They're not going to list those women because they don't consider them murdered. But we do, because we know that they were experiencing all this violence and abuse, and that there were suspicious circumstances that were never fully investigated because of system bias. So I think one of the strengths of the database is that we're able to call out that bias and affirm the voices of our own people saying, hey, something happened that was wrong. And that's really powerful.
It adds to data, but it also challenges the old data at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I learned very early on with SBI is that the database is very limited in terms of who can access it. Can you talk about the importance of keeping the database private and managing who can access, edit information, go through information?
Sure. So we treat the data as something that's living and breathing and that needs nurturing and care. And we treat it as something that's sacred. It's not meant for people to casually trawl through. It can be highly traumatic to work with. Both me and our data analyst have actually gotten physically sick from it before. And not just like nauseous because it's overwhelming, like actually sick. For example, she gets really bad migraines. It's also a really spiritual process to work with the data itself. And that doesn't mean that we're necessarily like, you know, playing traditional music and singing and doing ceremony all the time. But it does mean that we treat it with a certain level of care. And that means that it's not available for everyone. And that's also in keeping wishes with the families that we work with. So many of the families are very publicly outspoken. However, lots of them aren't, and they're not ready for that, or they don't want to do that. And they have a right to that. I think that shows just how sensitive this data is. There's real raw trauma in it, and it's not meant to be like, I know some people love watching the, you know, the murder shows on, I don't know, on those TV channels, or love even listening to podcasts about murder. It's very popular. But if it's done in a way that's voyeuristic and meant for casual consumption, that's really not ethical, and it can cause a lot of harm. Really, we should be hearing these stories to learn from them, to learn about the dynamics in our community, to learn how to support those impacted by it, and to learn how to change the system for better. So that's where the data access comes in. We do make the data available on an as-requested basis. So our website has our data protocols actually posted on it. So you can see all the kind of different detailed breakdowns of who gets what. But we always provide the data to tribes when they ask for it, or things like tribal DV programs or Indigenous anti-violence programs. That's a given. They always have access to the data they need. And then there's other kind of levels of access for other stakeholders, like activists or researchers or policymakers. But all of those protocols were put together by our board, and I consulted in that. But really, the idea behind it is that the data is sacred. It has to be protected that way. It can't be open for exploitation or abuse. And the best way that we can protect the families is by being really protective of their data and their stories.
And I think discussing this in terms of what SBI does can give listeners a way to think about maybe sometimes reframing interest in cold cases in terms of finding, you know, not all the time, but sometimes other ways to enrich the organizations that they want to support. So what's one way that our listeners could support the work that SBI does?
Well, I think there's lots of ways to get involved. Of course, we're a nonprofit, so donations always help, and you can make donations online at our website. But even outside of that, I think there's so much that really anybody can contribute to the MMIW movement. We published an MMIW organizing toolkit in May of this year, and that's free for download on our website. It's over 200 pages, and it's a workbook. It's meant to be interactive. So rather than us telling people how to get involved, it was basically giving folks the steps or the tools to figure out what their community needs. And it's got entry points for every kind of person doing any kind of work. So there's data, policy, boots on the ground volunteering, community healing projects, awareness building. No matter what it is, there's an entry point. And one of my favorite stories that I always share with people when they ask, like, well, you know, as an ally, how can I get involved? Is there's a non-Native woman, a white woman from Montana, who got really passionate about this issue. And the way she explained it to me was, she said, you know, I can't watch other moms lose their babies to this, because she was a mom of young children and just couldn't, it really pulled on her heartstrings. And so she didn't really, wasn't sure how to get involved in an appropriate way, and just thought, you know what, I've had it with all of these newspapers not covering this issue. And if my baby was missing, I would want every newspaper covering it. And so that's what she started doing. Every time a new case happened, she would call every newspaper in the state and basically harass them until they ran a story on it. And it got to the point where one of the newspapers told her, like, lady, you're harassing us. You need to let this go. And she said, like, look, I'm a stay-at-home mom. I can watch Frozen 5 times or I can keep calling you. And she called them so many times that they eventually published a public apology for their poor coverage of the issue and committed to covering each case as it occurs and doing kind of long form coverage of the issue indefinitely. So that was just one person being stubborn and making phone calls. So even if you don't have money to give or can't be out volunteering on a search, there are still things that you can do, even if it's just making phone calls or sharing flyers, that can make a big difference.
We've just read SBI's new report covering cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people in Northern California. Can you tell us about the impetus for this particular study?
Well, the study grew out of a partnership with the Yurok Tribal Court. The Yurok tribe is the largest tribe in California, and they're based on Northern California's coastline, directly south of the Oregon border. And their chief justice at their tribal court, Judge Abby Abenanti, is just a matriarch and an all-around badass. But she reached out to me in the months prior to SBI launching and said, hey, I'd really like to do something on this issue here locally. And as luck would have it, I grew up very close by to Yurok territory, about 40 minutes south, and was back living in the area. It was kind of funny. She had no idea that I lived here. And somebody was like, well, you know, her dad built your courthouse, right? my dad and my uncle own a construction company and had actually built the courthouse that she presides over. So it just kind of was meant to be. And that ended up being SBI's first big community partnership. So it definitely was an honor to get to partner with Judge Abby and the rest of the court. And what we decided to do was to try to do a really thorough study of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people from across Northern California. So not just Yurok folks, but anybody who's Indigenous and in this region, with the idea that the court and SBI in partnership could create new pilot projects that could address some of the gaps or some of the issues that lead to these cases or some of the reasons why the cases aren't brought to justice, that we could start working on those things together if we had a better sense of what the crisis looked like. So this is a 3-year project, and the report that we released in July is the culmination of the first year, and it's really the first data on MMIW in California at all. I think people forget that California Native people exist and think that California is just kind of beaches and palm trees and that Native people are only in, you know, deserts and the Great Plains. And that's not true. Native people are everywhere. But California has the most tribes out of any state, over 170, and also has the biggest urban Indigenous population. For example, San Francisco and Los Angeles have huge Native communities. So it was really important to kind of correct the narrative on MMIW and say, hey, wait a minute, California is being left out. And California is in the top 10 nationally. If Northern California were its own state, it would also be in the top 10 nationally. So there's a big issue that's being neglected here. And that was the aim of the report, was to really create a platform to correct that narrative by uplifting voices of families and survivors.
I read your findings pointed toward many cases being concentrated on what's called the Lost Coast, which I read in SF Gate is Humboldt, Mendocino, and Del Norte counties. Did your work lead to any theories or sort of like obvious factors as to why those counties in particular are apparent hotspots in this epidemic?
I think there's several reasons for that. And we're still actively studying on why that's the case. I will say I was born and raised in Humboldt County. I still live in Humboldt County. SBI's main office is in Humboldt County. And Humboldt County has the worst rate statewide for the highest number of cases. Having lived here for decades, what I can say is that our community here, and I would say Delmar and Mendocino are similar is that we have huge areas that are extremely rural. We have huge areas that have no cell service. There are some tribal communities that didn't get electricity till a few years ago, or don't have it at all. And so there's, you know, like I said, there's these stereotypes of California as being beaches and palm trees. And most people don't realize that, like, there's still another 7 hours of driving of California once you leave San Francisco, 8 hours. There's still a lot left of the state. And somehow they just forget that, like, there's these massive rural areas of the state that live a completely different reality than the beaches and palm trees that everyone thinks of. And part of that is very high rates of poverty, extreme rurality, very high rates of unemployment. And my whole lifetime, and even before that, I would say the last, gosh, every time I think 50 years, I'm like, wait a minute, I'm older than that. Like, well, I'm 29, but I mean, like, I'm always thinking back from like 2000, like, no, there's been 20 years since 2000. So I guess the last like 60 plus years, this region has been, the hub for marijuana cultivation nationally. And we're known as the Emerald Triangle for that reason. And even though marijuana is now legal in California, there are still thousands of illegal grows in this area. And some of them are quite large with thousands and thousands of plants. They not only destroy the environment, but they bring a general sense of lawlessness to the region. And what I mean by that is other drugs like meth and heroin, which are really high in use in this region, but also robberies, assaults, sex trafficking, murders. It just kind of unfortunately comes with the territory. And there's kind of a fabric of crime or violence that's in place here because of that. And then I would also say that here in this region, law enforcement, and we highlighted this in the report, law enforcement don't have the capacity to respond to crisis or violence as they probably should because of the extreme rurality and the massive areas they're expected to patrol. But I think also there's a culture of apathy in some of our law enforcement officers that they just don't care about Native people or about tribal communities and really don't know much about us. And unfortunately in California, because of Public Law 280, county sheriffs have jurisdiction over tribal land, not the FBI. And because county sheriffs have jurisdiction, it means that we're reliant on an outside agency that has very little accountability. And has very little investment in actually responding to violence in our communities in a good way. And so as the report laid out, that leads to a lot of instances of police violence and corruption too, which of course makes it even harder for Native people to call in for help or for cases to be reported.
How has the pandemic affected SBI's work and the families and communities that you support and work with?
The pandemic has been really challenging in a number of ways. Our Survivors Leadership Council did a really wonderful webinar back in April, and the video recording is available on our website if anyone wants to check it out. But they did a really wonderful webinar on the pandemic and its impact on MMIW and sex trafficking in our communities and how hard it can be. I know there's been kind of a national dialogue on domestic violence and how domestic violence has increased due to quarantines and the pandemic. But I think there's also a broader issue of financial precarity, just kind of it's easier for our kids and for our women to be manipulated right now and to be dependent on abusers. And those kind of create the perfect conditions for trafficking. So the webinar has some really great detailed information on that. I think in general, one of the things that we've seen is that the pandemic makes it really hard for families and their advocates to stay in contact with law enforcement. And most of the families we work with haven't heard from law enforcement since the pandemic really hit in March or April. And that can be really frustrating and terrifying for them. And even the ones that do hear from law enforcement, we have one family we work with where they're supposed to have a weekly call with the officer who's assigned to their daughter's case. And most weeks that call doesn't happen. He doesn't answer or he doesn't get back to them. And even when the call does happen, all he has to say is, well, you know, things are ongoing. I'm waiting to hear back from the lab. And he's been waiting to hear back from the lab for like 6 months. So it just, even when we do hear back, there's no progress. And so what concerns me is that our people are more vulnerable than they've ever been to these forms of violence, and that our law enforcement system and the justice system are completely unprepared to address it, much less address previous violence through the pandemic.
In your report, you also brought up the really low solve rates that you saw. Is there a relationship there between that apathy and that lack of morale and the solve rates you found among missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in Two-Spirit people in Northern California?
Absolutely. One of the most common experiences that we heard from every family that we talked to and every survivor too is that they had all been neglected by law enforcement. And the families in particular, every family we talked to had stories of trying to call tips and share information and being told basically to go away and let it go. Or almost every family we talked to, it had been over a year since they've heard from law enforcement on their loved one's case. Most of them don't get calls back. I've experienced that myself as an advocate for them. There's law enforcement agencies that we asked to do interviews for the project or that we reached out to on behalf of clients and families that we work with. And like to this day, I've still never heard from them. And that's really disappointing and frustrating. And I think a really kind of striking example was even in that article that came out, they featured Alicia Lara's case. And Alicia was murdered in Wichipec on the Yurok Reservation in 1991. And the reporter asked the Humboldt County Sheriff, can you speak to this case? And he pulled the case file and said, well, nothing in it looks suspicious, except I can't explain the positioning of her body. I can't explain why she was in the passenger seat of the car. So somehow it's not suspicious. And yet the car went over the cliff at 5 miles an hour and she was in the passenger seat alone in the vehicle. And no one called it in. So even after he did an interview with us, even after he committed to addressing this issue and acknowledged the failings of his department and the wrongdoings of previous sheriffs, like even after all of that, when there was immediately a new opportunity to say, hey, like we may need to reopen this case or we may need to reclassify it, instead, he just said, well, I don't think there's a problem with it, even though I can't explain a major component of what happened. That's it. Like, I can't think of a better example of the apathy that we see from law enforcement.
And how can our listeners support your work?
Well, I think the most important thing is, I know I've mentioned donations or jumping in to get involved in the movement, but I think the most important thing is to uplift families and survivors. So if anybody has a passion for this issue, there are Facebook groups and Facebook pages, there's websites, there's groups like us at SBI that are family and survivor centered, that, you know, even if you have no time and no money and like can't contribute anything, the one thing you can contribute is to say, like, instead of, it's great to make a social media post to educate your community on this issue, but make sure that you're sharing something that comes from families and survivors. There's videos on YouTube. There's all sorts of stuff, But and even if it's not in the context of a Native community, just in general, families and survivors have such powerful voices and powerful stories that all of us benefit from, because all of us benefit from a safer community. That even if you just take 30 seconds out of your day to uplift one of their voices and say, hey, this person has powerful things to say, I think you should listen to them, that makes a world of difference.
Are there any other projects or scholars or organizations you'd like to draw our attention to right now?
Yeah, I think there's so much great work being done on this issue. I think one of the best organizations to support is Sanish Scouts. It's S-A-H-N-I-S-H, Sanish Scouts. And they're led by Lissa Yellowbird Chase, who has been a dear friend and a sister for years. And Lissa is a survivor. She's a family member of a missing and murdered person. And she's also the most dedicated boots on the ground I know, and actually teaches people how to do searches for missing persons. And her specialty is finding missing Native people. So she has an incredible story. She just released an autobiography earlier this year. So she's definitely somebody to follow. I would also say Roxanne White, who's based in Seattle. She does incredible grassroots work on this issue. She's easy to find on social media. And she's just a powerhouse matriarch and also a dear friend and a sister. And both of them are on our Survivors Leadership Council. So those are the two that immediately come to mind in the U.S. The other folks that I would really love to give a shout out to are Danielle Uinen and her family. They're based in Canada, and the Uinen family is really matriarchs and kind of godmothers of the movement.
Thanks so much to Anita Lucchese for joining us to discuss her work. If you'd like to join us in donating to SBI's important work, you can find links in the show notes. And be sure to check out the Sovereign Bodies Institute and everything that they're working on, too. The Fall Line is a fully independent podcast. We appreciate listener support for our sponsors and for our show. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes that we care about. Join us on Patreon for early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters and Kim Fritz. Family and law enforcement interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced and engineered by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most grateful thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to the Black and Missing Foundation.